We are happy to have Beth Hemsworth back this morning. She's our staple every year. We have her at the care group, and I was thinking, what are some things you guys don't know about Beth Hemsworth? One is her daughter's here with her today. This is Laura right here in the front, which is awesome. And did you know that she is Jim Leffel's sister? That's an interesting fact, I think, that everyone knows. Also, she has an art studio that is down by 4th Street. Have any of you been to the art studio? There's somebody back there. Here's a PowerPoint if you want to write down there. She's having a special down there if you want to do some ceramics, like painting of the plates and mugs, and there's the prices and details there. Get a women's group to go down and hang out. That's a special thing here going up through December. Also, she's taught many parenting classes here at Xenos. And you can get, at the Study Center, she has a whole series called Building a New Generation. So you could check that out. And she's also a nurse and has been to Uganda to help some young mothers there. She's trying to get back to do that again. So in the Bible, there's this parable about people that have 10 talents and some people have 5 talents and some people have 1. We got a 10-talent person here, for sure. And she's offered them all up to God for his use. And I love that about her. So today she's going to talk about avoiding rebellion and a sense of entitlement in your kids by giving them a purpose and a vision for their life. So we're excited to see what God has put on her heart to share with us today. So why don't I pray and we'll bring her up. Well, God, I just thank you for every parent in this room. I know that they're here because they love their kids very much and they want to do a good job as parents. And your word says, if anyone lacks wisdom, you can ask you who gives it generously. So we just ask, God, that you will pour it on this morning, that you will use Beth to give us wisdom in raising our kids. And we just thank you for her willingness to share. So please speak through her today. Amen.
Thank you. Good morning. When I got up this morning and I saw the frost all over my car, I thought, boy, nobody's going to come because I'm really cold-aphobic. But I'm glad you're here. We're going to talk about, oh, and by the way, yeah, I didn't realize we were going to have a slide about this. Come on down to 4th Street Studio. We're right next to the Xenos facility at the pavilion. We have a lot of fun. You can have a women's night out and bring a bottle of wine and just chill. It's pretty fun. Mondays and Tuesdays we have mosaics and Wednesdays we have ceramics. Anyway. We're going to talk today, which way? I'm going the wrong way. No, catching up. Okay. We're going to talk today about agency, which is not a real normal parenting word. And I picked it just for that reason so we could think about it a little bit. And we're going to have some mics around the room. Who has the mics? Sherry has one back here, and Kim has another one. Because I'd really, really like to get some talk going and some discussion going about this. I was doing some research on the web just on the word agency because I thought it would be good to bring in some really succinct kind of definitions. But I found out a fun fact that I didn't know before. When you go on the Merriam-Webster Dictionary website, they have a whole section for currently made up words. And I just could not resist looking at some of that. I see some nodding here. Somebody else has adventured there. I ran across a word called sanctimommies. And I thought, oh, this will be perfect for a care group. Can anybody guess what a sanctimommy might be? Sanctimommy? Oh, come on. Sanctimommy is a mother who points out perceived faults in the parenting of others. It's sort of like, it's just a play on being sanctimonious. You can be a sanctimommy. And apparently, not only can you add your own definitions and make up your own words and post them on Merriam-Webster, I suppose there's some filtering system, but anyway. But you can also give an example of how you would use that word, and this came from someone's blog who apparently didn't like the supermodel involved in this. One example given was, sanctimommies of the world rejoice. You have a new spokesperson, and even though she's a supermodel, she's just like you. Self-congratulatory and anxious to make all the other mommies feel bad. So I don't know who this super mommy is, but she's becoming famous now for being a sanctimommy. I know that I have suffered from, no, I have suffered from and I have been very guilty of being sanctimommious over the years in a lot of ways. You know, I think that being a mom is such an important job and we put so much of ourselves into it, you know, and we want so badly for it to all go right that it's really easy to get our opinions together and then judge everybody else who looks at it in a different way. And I have stood guilty of that. And it's really fascinating now for me to be a grandparent because I've watched a whole generation of my friends' kids and my kids grow up. And I've realized that some of the things that I was really, really like, you know, oh, this is so important, haven't, you know, necessarily made a huge difference in the outcome in the kids, and other things have. And so it's kind of fun to be able to look back with a little bit of that personal perspective and realize that some of the things I was quite sanctimonious about maybe weren't that important. Anyway, hopefully in this group we can all just share ideas and not struggle with that issue. Today we're talking about agency, but as a means to talk a little bit about rebellion and entitlement. Because, I mean, really, when you think about it, you know, the kids here, you all have children that are pretty young, but what is it that you worry about when your kids get older? What kind of things do you worry about? How to make choices? Their friends. Yeah, we worry a lot about that. What else? Yeah?
They lose their faith.
That they would lose their faith. Mm-hmm. That they're going to, you know, be bombarded by tons and tons of influences, and they won't know how to deal with that. What else? Just fast things.
Their priorities.
You wonder what they're going to think is important in life. Yeah, these are all super important things. And we also tend to worry about, and these things, many of them reflect that they might have a rebellious attitude towards the priorities that we think are important, the faith that we try to help them to understand, and the direction that we hope that their lives will go in. So we worry about them rebelling from the way that we're trying to bring them up. We also worry, I hope, a little bit about the attitude of entitlement that so many young people have in our culture. And I'm sure we've all seen examples of it. You know, the I need what I want right now kind of an attitude and really being self-focused. Well, I think that one of the most significant ways that we can avoid some of these problems is by giving our children a very clear sense of agency. Most of the attitudes of rebellion or of entitlement develop why. Why does a child grow up being directed and being guided in a certain way for, you know, 10, 15 years and go off in a whole different direction? Why do they do that? Rebellion, okay. Well, why does that happen? What's going on inside of them that incites that?
Just human nature.
Human nature. You know what? This is a really important response because human nature is a large part of it. And there is a sense in which there is good rebellion because children need to separate themselves from their parents. They need to be distinct individuals. Does anyone here want to be a Xerox of their mother? No hands. Okay. That, you know, that's the whole point. We all want to be our own person. But there's a type of rebellion also that can be destructive in the life of a child. And what's going on usually in a kid's heart and mind that happens? What drives that?
They feel the need to assert themselves.
They may feel the need to assert themselves, which might imply
control.
A little too much control. Okay. Anything else? The appeal or the attractiveness of other things to do that they haven't experienced or things that their parents perhaps have prohibited and therefore that's even more attractive?
They know
I'm sorry?
They think
they know better, yeah. Sometimes they think they have a broader perspective than their parents. One reason that rebellion develops also, sometimes there's a good rebellion. Sometimes they see through some of our mismatched priorities. Or they see through the fact that, yeah, we say we really think this is the most important thing, but we don't tend to get around to doing it. And so not all rebellion is a bad thing. And sometimes there are some positive things that can come of it. But for the type of rebellion that is me-focused, and I just want to do what I want to do, and I don't care about the society or my family or who I affect, for that kind of rebellion, I think that one of the most important things that kids need is agency. So I want to take a couple minutes to think about what is agency. Anybody have any ideas? Agency. Linda? that they can be a person that makes a difference, okay? You hear about social agents or being an agent of change. Agency is the idea that I, as an individual, can have an impact on the world around me. Merriam-Webster says it's the capacity, condition, or state of acting or exerting power of operation. A person or thing through which power is exerted or an end achieved, or instrumentality. Now, this is a very cold dictionary kind of a definition, but what kinds of things, when we think about this from the perspective of bringing up a child and helping that child move into the adult world, what kinds of things does this bring to mind, this definition?
Self-esteem.
How does that tie in?
If they feel like they have a capacity to impact the world around them, then they have a strong sense of who they are. They're not second-guessing when other kids might say, maybe you're this, maybe you're that. And
great.
They have a strong sense of who they really are. And hopefully that would be as a child of God and be able to impact the world around them in a positive aspect.
Okay, so one of the things that a person who is an agent or sees himself as an agent in society needs is a significant level of confidence in who I am and where I'm going with my life. Okay? So agency requires confidence. Anything else about agency? Conviction? Would you grab the mic? Thanks.
Yeah, like what you believe to be true. You know, you really believe that what you believe is true.
Okay, so more than just confidence, which is essential, you also need to have a direction. You need to have a conviction that you've got a job to accomplish and that you're capable of moving in that direction. Okay, you guys are way ahead here. Aspects of agency. There's some synonyms, and I'm just going to kind of go through these real quickly because it kind of helps our thinking along the lines of what agency involves. An agency or an agent would be an instrument, a means, a medium, a ministry, a vehicle. Someone who is a determinant, someone who is a factor in what's happening in a situation. Someone who has influence, someone who's an ingredient, maybe a part of a team. Someone who is part of a mechanism, a tool, an activator, an animator, a catalyst. We think of our children as being a catalyst for positive things in the future. Someone who's a driver, an energizer, an executor, a generator. Impetus, incentive, and so on. Stimulus, trigger, cause. These are all words that talk about agency. And it does not mean that our children have to be the big leaders of the world. Because not all of our children will have leadership characteristics or personalities. What it does mean is that they would be significantly engaged with a group of people moving in a certain kind of direction. And they would be part of things moving forward. Well, why is agency so important? Any ideas? Why is agency so important? Why? Yes? Wait for the mic. Thanks.
I think it implies that there's a greater goal. There's something worth accomplishing or being a part of, not just floating around or whatever.
A person who has a sense of agency and who sees himself as an agent knows that they're working for something beyond themselves. Because an agent implies, like, what does a real estate agent do? Sells you a house. Is that real estate agent going to live in the house? So he's not just acting on his own, he's acting on behalf of somebody or acting on behalf of a group of people. So agency is really important because it gives kids and it gives us a sense of being involved. We were created by God to have an impact on the world. And this is a phenomenal thing. This is one of the most significant things that makes us different than animals and amoeba and accidental things. It means that we were created specifically so that our lives would have an impact on people around us. I love this verse in Ephesians 2:10 where it says, "We are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." Now, we are sitting here today on November, I think it's the 3rd, 2010. Think about the idea that maybe 10,000 years ago, God was thinking, someday I think I'm going to create a Linda, And yeah, she's going to have these characteristics, and I have so many cool things that she can do with her life. Now, she can choose to do them or not do them, but I've prepared them for her. And this person will be important to me and significant to the way that I'm moving history forward. Is that not an amazing perspective of history? To think that God, that we were in God's heart and in God's mind way before we were even born. And this is what this verse is saying in other verses of the Bible. We are agents. Every one of us was born with a purpose. And sometimes we feel that purpose and that calling really clearly and strongly, and sometimes we kind of flounder and we don't really feel that way. But this is what the Bible says about us, about every one of us and every one of our children. There's also a marvelous verse in the Old Testament in Jeremiah 22, where he's talking to the son of a king. And this son of the king was living a life that, well, he was an agent, but he wasn't an agent for good in the life of Israel. He was really leading the people off and asking God, why is it that, you know, you're not blessing me and prospering me? And so Jeremiah the prophet comes to him and is comparing him with his father, a king who really was an agent for good in the life of his people. And he spoke of the father, and one of the main characteristics of the father that Jeremiah pulls out is he says that he, your father, defended the cause of the poor and the needy, and so all went well. Didn't mean that the king didn't have any problems in his life, but because he was a king, things in the kingdom went well because he was defending the cause of the poor and the needy. And then he goes on to say, is that not what it means to know me, declares the Lord? I really feel touched by that idea that what it means to really know God is to be involved as his agent in the world around us in making a difference with poverty and with need, be it spiritual need, physical, emotional, or whatever. But, you know, it's an amazing role of significance that God has given us to be able to be agents in the world. We need to matter. We, each one of us, have inside of us a deep need. I want to matter. We don't maybe even use those exact words, but can anybody relate to having that feeling of needing to matter to somebody or to something? Yeah, I always have. Even as a seven-year-old, and I don't know why, I was probably because of this melancholy personality, but I remember as a seven-year-old, you know, walking in the rain and thinking, I want my life to be different than just the kind of humdrum thing that I saw around me. I want to matter. I want to do something important with my life. You know, and all of us feel that way at different times. But think about our life right now. What makes our life matter? I mean, you know, we're living in Columbus, Ohio, and we are mothers. Some of us are grandmothers. And the roles that we're in, what makes our life matter? What makes my life matter today? Does anybody feel like they matter today? What makes your life matter? Anybody? Yeah?
Well, being a parent.
Being a parent matters. How does that matter?
Well, if your children especially are younger, you have a, you know, a responsibility or an ability to help them grow and
yeah, you have young wives depending on you who couldn't even survive if you weren't around. Okay. So that's one way our life matters. How else does our life matter? Why does my life matter today? Yeah, Kelly?
I think as wives and families as well, having an impact on the neighbors and friends.
As wives and families, we can have a huge impact on the neighbors around us. Sure. You know, it's interesting whenever I talk to people who have active neighborhoods. A friend of mine who's an artist at a gallery where I work lost a neighbor recently. She was pretty young, not to you guys maybe, but she's only like 45 or 50. And she died very suddenly, and it was a huge impact to the whole neighborhood because she was the one who really organized and got people together and created the community and brought about that sense of community. There are a lot of reasons why our lives matter today. We matter today because we matter to God, and he placed us where we are today. We matter today because we are nurturing a whole new generation of people who will be agents for God. We matter today because we can have and we do have a spiritual impact on the people around us. We matter because each one of us is building something in our lives, in our fellowship, in our community that will be important to other people. What do I do that reflects agency? Again, it's the things that we do that matter. And the thing I want to bring up today is that children are people too. What would it be like for you if you didn't feel like you mattered? How would you feel if you didn't think that anything you did was significant? Has anybody ever felt that way? I have. It's depressing, exactly. It's depressing. Anything else?
Helpless.
Helpless? Okay, you feel helpless. If you feel like nothing you do matters, then you feel like you're helpless. Yes?
Like inward focus.
Inward focused.
Thinking about other people, I'm only thinking about myself.
Okay. If I feel like I don't matter, then it doesn't matter what I do, and so I can get really self-focused, inward focused. Do you? Yes, way back there.
I'd say just really angry.
Angry? Really? How do you get? How does not mattering make you angry?
I would say getting angry because if you don't matter, you're like, why am I here?
Uh-huh.
You know, I have nothing to do, like, you know, because I was adopted.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of like, well, why'd you adopt me then? You know, like if I don't matter to my parents.
Oh, okay.
Something like that.
So it feels like life isn't fair if you don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important one. And I think that that's true. If we don't matter, one of the reasons that it makes us angry is because since we were created to matter, since the God of the universe made us to matter, if we don't feel like we do, we're at odds with reality. We're at odds with something fundamental in our hearts. And so it does generate self-focus. It does generate depression. It does generate anger. Now, what about children? The last couple of years, every time I come to care group, I keep saying children are people too. Because what I want to get across is that they have the same drives and the same needs in their hearts that we have in ours. And so what does it mean for children? What do children feel like if they don't think that they matter? What do you see in children who think they don't matter? Same kinds of things. What were you saying? Sad. Anybody else?
A lack of development.
Lack of development. How do you mean that?
Just with kids who aren't given like a lot of interaction, it like affects their health and their...
Kids who aren't given very much interaction, it affects their health, it affects their ability to relate to other people, okay? If they don't feel like they matter. Kids who, here's an extreme example of a kid who would not have felt like they mattered. When I was in college and I was in the emergency room at Children's Hospital, someone brought in a child who was probably 9 or 10 months old, but this child had never been, the mother was 16 and this was her second child and she was living in an abandoned house. So this makes me sad. This child had been just like laying on the floor for months and had not been changed regularly, had not been fed regularly, and was completely unable to make any kind of eye contact. This child didn't matter. Now, this is an extreme example of it, but can you think about a 5 or a 10 or a 15-year-old child who feels like they don't matter? You know, there's a vacancy in who they are. There's an inertia to who they are. There's an inability to take in the nutrition when they do get it. There's an inability to connect with the world around them. And children are people too. So they need to feel like they matter just as much as we need to feel like we matter. Now, when we think about that idea, and I really truly believe that a huge percentage of the angst and the rebellion and the difficulty that we experience with our children as they're preteens and teenagers comes precisely from this concept, that they don't feel like they matter. So let's think about this a little bit. Turning our children into mere consumers and passive recipients of our attention and entertainment dehumanizes them. Really? Isn't that a little strong? It dehumanizes them? What do I mean by that? Turning our children into mere consumers and passive recipients of our attention and our entertainment dehumanizes them. Any thoughts about that? Let's see if we can get a mic to... Yes?
Yeah, you're just turning them into a thing.
Turning them into a thing.
They're not a person. They're just passive recipients. Like
okay, what about personhood is missing if they're passive recipients?
I'm sorry?
I think you have a fantastic point. I'm just trying to pull it out a little bit more. What about being a human being or being a person do they not have if they're just a passive recipient?
They have no person. They aren't a person. They don't feel like a person.
Yeah, part of what being a person is being able to relate and connect with the world around us. Just one second, wait for the mic.
I was just going to say the engaging with another person and connecting with them, just what you said.
Right. So. It's one of the things that makes humans human is engagement in relationship. You know, I know that a lot of animals can be very affectionate and all that, but they're not proactive and they're not out seeking, you know, to better the world around them. Human beings are. Human beings are unique in this sense, and it's a real need that we have inside of us to feel like we make a difference and to be able to truly make a difference in the lives of people around us. So I don't think I'm going too far when I say that there is a significant sense in which kids feel dehumanized or kids feel less than what we want them to feel like as humans when they're mostly just passive recipients of our attention. What does it feel like when you feel like you've made a real contribution to somebody else's life? Just some quick answers. What does it feel like?
Rewarding.
Why? Rewarding. Here, I said a quick answer and then I went and asked to explain it. Sorry.
Well, just to feel like you've actually had something to contribute to help, you know, to make someone better, to help them. You just feel significant.
You feel significant. You feel more alive. I find that when I have had a significant investment in somebody's life and I see some movement from that or something, some reward from that, I feel more alive. I feel more energetic. I feel more connected with people. What does it do for our perspective about our own life? Has anybody ever struggled from thinking they have it kind of bad? Yes?
I guess what it does with our life is it kind of cleans out the crap and makes you focus on things that are more important. I find I'm less attracted to entertainment and to shopping.
Yeah.
If I'm spending my time thinking about other people and trying to do something useful.
Yes. That's really cool. It is so exciting, and it makes us feel so vital and so alive when we see that there's some positive results of something that we can do, that it drives us to want to do more. And it makes some of the distracting things less attractive. And it's exactly the same thing with kids. So children were created to strive, to create, and to nurture. I like the idea that that God created us this way. And children need to strive. They need to struggle, and they need to have something ahead of them that's a big challenge. And I think that when kids don't have a challenge and they don't have something to struggle for, they tend to end up struggling against. And this is where a lot of that kind of rebellion idea comes in. People need to be needed in order to feel significant. And so I think we can trace a lot of adolescent angst and the rebellion to the pent-up need to be part of something and to work to see things accomplished. Does anybody have any thoughts about that? We were all teenagers at one point, you know, and we all needed to separate from our parents, and some of us were more rebellious than others. But at least in my case, the rebelling that I did against my parents had to do with a pent-up need to be significant and a need to do something that I thought was important. And my rebellion was going to college and, becoming a Christian. That was not well-received at first. Choosing a major where I would be having hopefully an impact on people in nursing, which was not well-received, and then marrying somebody who was wanted to be in full-time ministry, and that was not well-received as well. So sometimes our rebellion, you know, it can take an awful lot of different forms, but I was willing to confront my parents, and I was willing to pay the price because it was so important to matter, you know, and I think an awful lot of kids are in that very same kind of place. Kids are, by nature, idealistic. Has anybody ever seen a two-year-old take his favorite blanket or his favorite toy that he never lets anybody touch and voluntarily give it to another child because they're crying? Isn't that amazing? You know, there is something that God has put within us from the cradle, from the very earliest moments of our life, that is altruistic. There's something in us that has empathy and wants to reach out to other people. Children are by nature idealistic. They want things to go well. And we as parents can either really work for that or we can work against it. And now I want to put in a plug for my favorite parenting book of all time, and it's called The Moral Child. And it's not about discipline or bedtimes or feeding or anything like that. The whole thesis of the book, it's a secular study done by a guy named William Damon at Brown University, and it's been around for a few years, But the thesis of the book is that all of moral development is dependent on the development of empathy, and that our children are empathetic by nature, and that we can either nurture that empathy, such as when that child wants to give away his favorite toy, you know, encouraging him, you know, yeah, you can let that kid, you know, help him comfort that child, or we can discourage the child's natural empathy, which is what we often tend to do as well. So children are already by nature idealistic, and that book was The Moral Child. It's by William Damon. We can work against that by giving them too much and distracting them. Now, how does giving them too much work against their natural sense of idealism and empathy? Any ideas? How does giving them too much work against their natural empathy?
I don't know. I just had a thought that possibly by giving them too much, it causes them to just be more self-focused.
Okay. It enables them to be more self-focused. It also enables them to spend a lot of time with all the stuff they have, so they don't necessarily have a lot of time for other things. Anything else? Yeah?
It causes them to never feel what it's like to need something.
Okay.
They never will get that emotion.
Mm-hmm. That's a really significant point. It doesn't cause them to need things or to feel... It doesn't cause them to need things, but I wonder if they don't still feel an inner sense of it's not quite enough. You know, but certainly it's very distracting, and it doesn't give them time to need things or to think about other things. Anything else on this one? Yeah?
Makes them want more.
Just
that feeling of you know, getting things, it never does end.
There's something about our being human beings, and because our children are intelligent, they can absorb what a thing is pretty quickly. And it's when it's new and it's shiny and they just got it, it's very, very exciting and it's very distracting. But there does come a time fairly quickly, usually, where they have intellectually conquered this object. It doesn't fascinate them any longer. They've either figured out how it works or they've figured that somebody else has a bigger one or whatever, but it just isn't a long-term kind of thing, you know. All right. Children are idealistic, and we can work against that by telling them, in essence, that they either aren't competent or shouldn't be bothered with contributing to the lives of other people. Now, that's kind of a long thing. What does this mean? How do we tell them that they shouldn't be bothered with other people? How do we subtly convey that message? Yes.
Just 1 second.
Modeling it ourselves.
Can you think of a way that we model that?
Not being bothered to contribute to the lives of others ourselves, like what we do with our time.
Yeah, what we do with our time. You know, if we can't be bothered with people, then it's going to be really hard for our kids to be bothered with people. We used to live in a large city about 1,000 miles up the Amazon where there were a lot of poor kids and kids who would be out on the street. And there were certain kids who'd be out on certain streets at times that we would pass. And I remember thinking at the time, we really need to stop and give these kids some food. And we started carrying food in the car because we knew on certain days that those certain kids would be there for whatever reason. And sometimes, oftentimes we would stop and give the kids food for two reasons. One of them is because the kids outside of the car needed food. What was the other reason? Because the kids inside the car needed to know that that was an important thing to do. And when people would come to our door almost every day looking for either food or money or clothing, we got to a point where we almost always would send our kids to the door. And they would have to be kind and polite to those people. And we had kind of like a stock of things that they were allowed to give away and all that. But we can work for that idealism, and we can help that idealism to nurture and be developed, or we can work against it as well. Some of the ways that we work against the idealism of children are simply ways that we feel like we can't help. Like there was a request recently on Zenos Misk for a young woman who needs a place to live. You know, well, we're kind of full up at our house, you know, and we're all kind of full up. And it's hard to know, well, you know, should I help here, should I help there? But sometimes working through those things in front of our kids and with our kids helps them to understand we are concerned. You know, maybe we'll respond to this need, maybe we won't, but that we're always responding to some kind of needs. And it helps them to get the idea that they can do these things too. And yet sometimes we work against it just by living such isolated lives. A lot of times we feel like our children shouldn't be playing with problem children. Does anybody ever have that idea? You know, maybe your kids aren't old enough to be playing with other kids, but sometimes we think that that would be a bad thing for them. There was a point at which we lived in a place where people lived mostly with high walls because there was a lot of crime, and all the houses had walls and all the houses had bars on the windows. And a friend of mine was deeply critiquing on numerous occasions the fact that I would let my child play with the street kids play soccer. And I just felt like I have to let him play soccer with these kids. What am I teaching him if I tell him that these kids aren't good enough and that you can't talk to them and you can't interact with them? Well, the day came when one of them got mad and threw him on the ground and broke his arm. So I was taking him to school with his arm to elbow, you know, arm to shoulder cast, and thinking, oh, my friend is really going to let me have it now because she's been warning me for months that I shouldn't let my kid play with these kids. And her kid got out of the car on that same day with the same cast on. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing. And I went up to her and I said, hey, what happened to your kid's arm? Oh, and she didn't say it this way, but basically what happened was he was playing all by himself behind his 9-foot walls in his own yard with a ball by himself. He tripped on it and fell and broke his arm. You know, and I just thought, well, isn't that kind of a cool thing? You know, because we're going to get beat up by the world one way or another. You know, and there are things that are going to happen. But, and I'm not suggesting that we throw our children out to the wolves and then we don't pay attention to them, but sometimes when they're problem children, we can have them over at our house. Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't send my kid over to a lot of other kids' houses because I don't know what's going on there with their parents, but we can have them at our house and that kind of thing. We teach them to be involved with people. Let's get the mic over here, please. Oh, sorry, you got it.
I think on the tail end of what you said, Ward, I contribute to it because I don't know how to help them, like in the area of being bitter. If I'm bitter, I'm not going to teach them how to be forgiving because I'm not forgiving.
Right.
And so that's kind of how I protect them by don't have relationships. You know, if they piss you off, then just, you know,
wow, that's
go
a fantastic
away
example.
Because I don't know how to do that. So mm-hmm. kind of I can't give to my kids what I don't do myself.
Right. Our kids see it. When we go through serial best friends or serial close relationships, our kids see that. Was there somebody else? Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking, too, that one way I want to protect them is by not having them face rejection.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a daughter that's 3, and she initiates with everybody, and most mm-hmm. times people don't say hi back, and then she gets really confused. And uh-huh. so I think what I try to communicate to her is don't even try to say hi. Don't even try to find out about people because most people aren't going to respond to you. Where the truth is, she's going to get rejected all the time, and at some point she just has to learn how to deal with that if she's going to have successful relationships.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, instead of telling her, don't bother, we could tell a child like that, you know, a lot of people are just kind of busy thinking about themselves, and they're not going to respond to you. But it's okay, because keep going, because you will always find people who will respond to you. We moved around a number of times when our kids were little, and every time, you know, was the worry, you know, would there be friends? Would there be friends for us? Would there be friends for them? You know, what would life be like relationally? And every time we would just really pray that God would bring some positive people into our lives. And, you know, I remember having the feeling in almost every city I have ever lived, darn, there is just not enough time to get to know all the cool people who live in this city. You know, we can choose to look at it that way because there are really cool people wherever we go. So our kids see how we relate to other people, whether or not we're willing to take something to a food pantry or whether or not, you know, we do those Christmas boxes every year, those shoe boxes with the stuff in it for the kids. Our kids see that. They're idealistic, and they love the idea that they're contributing to somebody else. So it's cool to get to do that together. Children are idealistic, and we can work against that by promoting relational immaturity. How do we promote relational immaturity? Well, what you were talking about back here is a good one, you know, that they see us being bitter and they see us going from friend to friend. What else? Over here, Kelly.
That whole focusing on feelings and rights, that's one thing that I really realized a couple years ago, the lies that I had told myself about my rights.
Mm-hmm.
And you can project that onto your children really easily of, you know, I have a right to be heard, or I have a right to be liked, or, you know, those kinds of things, rather than encouraging them, like the last lady said, you know, they're going to get rejected, and working through those things. And one thing that I'm always telling my little guy, because his answer to everything in his arguments with his brother is, he hurt my feelings. Like, Andrew, you need to protect your feelings. You uh-huh. need to, like...
Wow, that's a good perspective.
Like, don't be so thin-skinned is what I really want to say here. Uh-huh. But it is an important thing, because you are going to go out in the world and people are going to hurt you. But if you know, like what you said earlier, your sense of agency, your sense of purpose in the world, those fringe people in 20 years don't really matter anyhow. But mm-hmm. I think that we need to encourage that with our kids, not that they don't matter, but you know what I mean? Like, you're not going to remember that, and it's not going to be the focus.
It won't ruin your life.
It won't ruin your life if you know where you're going. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, if our kids know where they're going, nothing will be able to stop them. It's an amazing thing that God has created us to be directed and has created us to have an energy within us that wants to accomplish good things. And so sometimes people will say, well, my child doesn't do such and such anymore because somebody hurt his feelings at the Boy Scout meeting, or somebody, you know, hurt his feelings at a church thing, and so it's the church's fault that he doesn't go anymore, or somebody, whatever. You know, our kids aren't that dependent. They don't need to be that dependent on the small things that happen with other people. And we can teach them that from a really early age. When some kid is mean to them and they feel hurt, we can say, yeah, I would feel hurt too. I understand that. You know, but so-and-so is our friend, so we're going to need to go talk to him, or we're going to need to go work it out, or whatever. We're not just going to throw him out and not talk to him anymore or play with him anymore because he said something that we didn't like. Is this making sense? I'm sure it is. This is all not new stuff. But I want to look at the idea of what is biblical agency. Biblical agency would be that our children are capable and visionary. So we were talking about that before, the idea of confidence and the idea also of having a vision for life. Biblical agency is the sense that we have that I can make things happen and God can use my life in ways that make a difference. Now, this is not an arrogant thing at all. I mean, we don't have time to talk about what is godly humility and all of that, and dependence on God working in our lives. But we really should be able to know as adults, as mature adults, and we should be building in our children the idea that I really can make things happen. I am an agent in the world that I live in. And God can use my life in a lot of different ways that make a difference. That's biblical agency. It's not the same thing as self-esteem. And I don't want to pick on you using the word self-esteem because I don't think you were using it that way. But you guys are all, most of you, you know, if you were born in the late 70s and in through the mid-late 80s, you're like the self-esteem generation because all the schools and all the teachers and everybody was trying to build self-esteem. It was like the mantra of the 80s. Does anybody remember any self-esteem things that happened at school or whatever? Linda, there's a mic behind you.
A lot of us remember the IOLAC sign. Remember,
oh, yeah.
We walked around with I am lovable and capable, and people would write things about you that make you lovable and capable. So those kinds of things. I'm sure some of us remember that.
Okay, there was IOLAC. Anything else? There's one over here.
Free to be you and me.
Free to be you and me. I didn't catch that one. What is that?
It was my kindergarten graduation play.
Oh, okay.
But there was music that was very popular at the time. And
uh-huh. Okay, free to be you and me. Any other examples? Has anybody... I went to a soccer game probably in the late 80s, and it was so interesting because they had it was like the end of the season, and they had the trophies. And I thought, you know, soccer season, you know, one team probably won, and so there'd be a trophy, maybe there'd be a runner-up trophy or whatever. And I walked in, and there were 2 6-foot-long tables, and they were covered with trophies. And I thought, this is really strange. What is this all about? Well, you guys probably know. What was that all about? Who got a trophy? Everybody got a trophy, you know, or everybody got a ribbon. Or whatever. That whole movement was all about, you know, making us feel good and making us feel like we can do anything and all that kind of thing. So now, from the perspective of adults, how's it working for you? Seriously. What do you think about it now? Now that you're not the adults, or now that you're the adults and not the kids growing up with that. Kelly?
I know I've talked a lot, but there's that line in the Incredibles movie where the kid goes, well, saying everybody's special is really saying nobody's special at all.
Yeah.
And that's how it felt. Like,
did it?
Yeah. I mean, like, what makes you different if we're all so great, or, you know, or maybe I'm not as great as they're saying, or, but it is this just like blanket thing that
right.
doesn't really mean anything.
Did it make you feel more confident?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what I'm after here, is this whole idea. It's not that we're just trying to build up our kids' self-esteem. We're not just trying to say, oh, you're marvelous, when they don't really even have to do anything to be marvelous. You know, but biblical agency is helping them to develop who they really are inside, is knowing them well enough to see their personality traits and their capabilities, and helping them to work in directions that put those to a really positive kind of a use. The whole self-esteem thing was a bonanza for the comedy industry. You know, and I'm sure you all remember the comic of the one penguin, you know, out of the millions of penguins that all look exactly alike going, I want to be me. You guys remember that one? Yeah. Anyway, there were a lot of self-esteem things. And why doesn't it work is exactly like what Kelly said, because it makes us, like, if everybody's special, nobody's special. So it's not, biblical agency is not just trying to make kids feel good about themselves. Biblical agency is actually teaching them specific skills, both relationally and functionally and spiritually, so that they can move forward in specific kinds of ways. So if self-esteem is not the goal, what is the goal? What is the goal of life if it's not to feel good about ourselves? What do we want for our children? Yeah?
In helping them see what their gifts, God-given gifts are,
so that they can use those gifts in a way that, you know, helps the community, helps everything.
Yeah, the goal is we want our kids to be happy, and we want our kids to have good self-esteem in the positive, healthy sense of the word, and we want them to be fulfilled, but that's not really the goal. The goal is that we and our children reflect the person and the goodness of God. You know, that's the goal of life. Sometimes people think some of you here are Christians and some of you aren't, and some people think that the goal of the Christian life is to stop sinning or to be good. You know, and frankly, that's not the goal. You know, the goal of the Christian life is not to stop sinning, because it's impossible. It is absolutely impossible. And it's not even to be good all the time, because that's not possible either. We have to have goals that are realistic, otherwise we'll be really frustrated by them. The goal of life is for the person of who God is to be manifest through us by the fact that we're developing and using the talents and gifts that he gave us. And that's an exciting goal. One, because it's attainable in every life, and another because when we're working in symphony with who our Creator is, we just feel wonderful. I mean, it just gives us, doesn't mean we feel elated all the time, because we have a lot of struggles to face in life, but it gives us a stability that no other thing can give us. So here I'm going to bring up, open a little bit of a can of worms about this, if you'll go with me on this. Our children need to know that my life matters, that I matter. Some of you who have taken the New Generation course or who have looked at the notebooks are familiar with this, diagram here. It's about personal well-being, security well-being, needing columns. Our children need to know that they're lovable, which gives them a sense of security, that they're acceptable, that they are capable, and that they're at peace with other people, and that these things are really intrinsic to who they are as people and social needs that they have. They need to know that they matter. And it's the I am capable part where what we're talking about today, that I do what I do matters. We can either build that on a rock-solid foundation. I am capable, I matter, because I was created by a living God who put in me characteristics and capabilities that can be brought forth for the benefit of the world around me. Or we can teach them that I am capable and I matter because I'm a really good soccer player and I know all the IT stuff better than my mom, and I make really good grades. And which one of those is really going to help them in the long run in their lives? I'm bringing this up because I think that the need to matter is so strong that we sometimes fall into rewarding them too much for the wrong kinds of things so that they'll feel like they matter to us. And I'm going to get back to this in a few minutes, but here, this is the model that represents needs, and there is a rock and a sand way to go about teaching our kids that they are capable. Just like there's a rock and a sand way to say that to learn teach kids that they're lovable. When we look at being lovable, for example, if we tell our kids, "I love you because you have such gorgeous brown eyes," you know, or "I love you because you bring me coffee when I ask for it," or "I love you because you don't interrupt at the dinner table," or "I love you because you make good grades," or "I love you because you just are so smart." You know, those are "I love you" messages that are going to make a kid feel pretty insecure. But we can also say, "I love you because you were made by God and given to me as this wonderful present, you know, and I just think that you as a person are fantastic." You know, there's a whole different kinds of ways that we can give messages to our kids about each of these areas. And the one about "I am capable" involves this area of agency. I want to go through a couple of practical things for children and then get back to the issue of the rebellion and boredom thing. But practical agency for children, some things that children can learn to do are so easy. You know, well, you know, you can put like a little bit of dirt in a cup and throw a seed in it and water it. I mean, that's just the easiest thing in the world. But how does something as simple as that teach agency? How does something as simple as that teach agency to our kids? Yeah.
Off the top of my head, I imagine that just gives them the sense of responsibility for something else other than themselves.
Yeah, it can help give them a sense of responsibility because you're asking them to water it every day until the thing comes up. What else over here? Just when the mic's coming.
Cool. Without one part of that equation, it won't grow.
Exactly.
Without the watering, without the sun, without the soil.
Exactly. It's one of the simplest possible ways to teach our kids about agency and to be able to say, "Look at this. We put this in 2 days ago, and it was just a little bean, you know, and now it's got this green shoot. You know, look what, you know, what watering it has done and doing all these different little things for it has done. What would happen if we stopped watering this little seed? Well, it would die." You know, and so the children keeps watering it, and the plant grows, and it's a really, really simple way to say, "We accomplished something. We made a difference." And you can even have some other beans that you leave in a cup with no dirt, and they still look like the same beans that they were a week ago. But this bean that we did something to, you know, is already growing up in our windowsill. Simple, simple, simple way to help our kids learn a little bit about agency. Here's another practical agency: taking care of an animal regularly. You know, that's a little bit older kids. But there's something just amazingly useful in a kid's life to know that they're contributing to a small life and able to help that animal grow. Practical agency for children. Here you see kids sweeping the floor. This little kid can, you know, is probably not even as tall as that vacuum cleaner is long, you know, and doing different things. But why is this so hard for us to do, this practical agency for kids? Why is this such a difficult thing to accomplish? Yes?
It's quicker and easier to do it ourselves.
It's really quicker and easier to do it ourselves.
We do it
by
better,
far.
Yeah. So.
We do a far better job. You know, we do a far better job, and yet it's so cool to see kids to say, "I know how to do this," you know? Do any of you have kids that run around after you say, "I want to do it, I want to do it"? Yeah, I see some nodding. And that's so healthy that they get to do things like that. So some of these practical things, when we're talking about agency, sometimes it's a little overwhelming because we're talking about life vision, we're talking about changing the world, we're talking about impact on our neighborhood. And so I'm trying to like narrow it back down again for a little bit and just say that, you know, a lot of things about agency are really pretty simple. You know, and we can let our kids do things, and even if they don't do a great job, we can go along with them and they can see some results of their labors. Here's another one, practical agency for children. Helping with the care of another little child. You know, it's easy when there are little siblings in the home and you can bring home the baby and they can help you gather up things that you need or go get a diaper or different things like that. And if you don't have any new babies in your family, you could borrow one from somebody. You know, I'm sure you have a lot of friends who wouldn't mind if you borrowed their baby for a little while. There, I saw don't remember if it was in Time magazine, I think it was, there was a fantastic article a couple of months ago about a program in Canada where they're trying to teach kids empathy. They've read William Damon on The Moral Child, too. I mean, they understand that the whole bullying thing that's going on in the junior high and the high school now that is so dangerous and so such a huge problem happens because kids don't have empathy for one another. And so what they do is they get a mom with a baby, and she brings her baby to class in September, and every couple of weeks or once a month through the whole school year, that mom brings her baby back, and the kids get to see the baby in different phases of its development. But they see, you know, why does the baby cry, and they talk about it together. You know, oh, well, the baby needs milk, the baby needs this or that. They just talk about the baby's feelings. You know, they get to watch the baby kind of crawl around, and they think, oh, well, don't let the baby get hurt. We need to move things out of the way. And it has been making a huge difference. Kids have been learning a lot about empathy just by being around a really small child during their time at school. And, you know, it used to be that all of us were exposed to little children as a natural course of life. Because before the industrial era, when everybody lived in isolated houses in the cities, we all had extended families. And we learned those kinds of things almost by nature. And now we have to kind of go out of our way to make sure that these things happen. So things that were normal to us, perhaps as children, if we had younger siblings or if our mothers made us, my mother used to get up every Saturday morning and make the list. Greg's going to do this, and Beth is going to do this, and Jim's going to do this, and Judy's going to do that, and she'd write out all the stuff, all the dusting and house cleaning and all that we had to do. But if we don't have those kinds of structures in our lives anymore, we have to kind of make them up and find ways for our kids to experience agency. And one of the most important things about agency and being able to work in other people's lives is emotional vocabulary. That's kind of weird. Now, what does emotional vocabulary mean? If you have an idea, put up your hand and you can get a mic. Emotional vocabulary. Yeah, you and then you.
Isn't that just teaching kids to recognize people's feelings? Like, aren't there studies about how kids today don't know, like, if a person is angry, if a person is sad, they have a real hard time recognizing that? Is that
what typically,
kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's pretty much what I'm talking about, and over here as well.
I was just going to say that it's knowing how to verbalize your feelings.
Mm-hmm. Knowing how to verbalize your own feelings and knowing how to perceive the feelings of others. I mean, we can't get inside their head and really know, but there are certain things we can learn about it. There was a book that came out about 10 or 15 years ago called Raising Cain, and it was about raising boys. And one of the fascinating things about this book was that they did a study about how mothers raise boys and how mothers raise girls. And this is an enlightened era. You know, we're all enlightened about gender differences, and we don't want to make our girls all prissy and our boys all macho. So you would think that we would raise them pretty much the same, right? Well, they actually had researchers sit in parks for days and or however long, and they would watch as mothers would come along with their young children. If a child fell over and got hurt, the mother who had a girl would lean down and say, "Oh, honey, look at that little boy over there. See how sad he is? He must be really upset." You know, and then they'd go on because somebody's already taken care of the child that got hurt. But if a mother had a boy, they would just keep on walking and not make any comment. Now, isn't that interesting? For some reason, there's a tendency among us to not teach our boys emotional vocabulary. And the book was about how many men don't have it. Does anybody have a husband who is either fine, not fine, mad, or happy? And that's the extent of his emotional vocabulary? I won't ask you to raise hands. You know, nothing personal. But it's often the case. And women are pretty much that way, too, a lot of times. It's not just the guys. But an emotional vocabulary is essential to developing empathy and essential to our idea of agency and being able to make a difference. We have to understand what people's needs are before we can move in and meet those needs. So emotional vocabulary is a huge part of one of the things that we need to help our kids to develop. They need it because they need it to be able to connect with other kids. What time is it? I always talk too long. How much more time do we have? Cool. All right. How can we develop emotional vocabulary? I think we've already pretty much kind of discussed that. By by telling our kids, you know, oh, that baby looks really frustrated because he keeps trying and trying and trying to reach something and can't reach it. Oh, there's a word, frustrated. Now I know a little bit about what that means. I want something that I can't get, you know, or just different kinds of words. Oh, I think that little child is disappointed because, oh, they're handing out candy and, oh, there isn't any left. That child looks disappointed, you know, or another child, you know, gets pushed over and gets up and is mad. You know, that child is angry. Using the emotional vocabulary, helping them to understand not only what they feel, but what other people feel is really helpful. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about boredom and resentment. And we did already talk about it some, but why do you think that they are so much a part of current adolescent culture? People that I know that work with junior high and high school kids and even college-level students often talk about a sense of boredom and a sense of resentment that the students have. Any ideas on that? Why is there so much boredom and resentment among young students? Linda, just a second. There's a mic.
As they've aged, we've taken all their responsibilities away, and so when it comes time where they're actually able to do these things, well, you can just do it, Mom. You know, they have that idea that I'm not going to be able to do it as well as you. You're just going to criticize me, so you just go ahead and do it. So there's nothing for them, quote, unquote, nothing for them to do.
Yeah. I think one of the most common complaints that any child over about 8 years of age tells their parents is, I'm bored, you know, and needs to have something else. Because so often, from the very earliest times, our children are groomed to be takers and recipients, takers and recipients, takers and recipients, because they have so many programs for them. You know, at school, they receive everything. You know, at church, in their youth groups, they receive and receive and receive. And from us, they receive and receive and receive. And we think that we're just giving them so much, and we're giving them so many opportunities. We're enriching their lives in so many ways. And yet, if we teach them to be takers, and if we allow them to have a posture of passivity through their growing up years, they're going to end up bored and restless, because we as human beings need to be givers as well as takers. You know, there have been grumblers and resenters since the beginning of history, but this post-industrial era in the developed world is the first time ever that we've had a whole culture that is characterized by that. Sherry, did you have something?
I was going to just say, with the whole gaming system and everything, people, I mean, kids are learning to be entertained at 1 and 2 years old, you know, and then it's bigger games, it's better games, and I know a lot of my friends whose kids have gotten older that they're bored with life because the fantasy of the games and, you know, the make-believe is so much more exciting, you know, and so I know that's one big reason why there's a lot more boredom.
Yeah, that's good. I was kind of thinking on my way up here, when I was a teenager, the thing that was so upsetting to my parents is that my brothers, you know, grew super long hair, and I walked around in jeans with holes in them and had, you know, long braids and all this kind of stuff, you know, that kind of hippie era. And my parents were just so upset about that and the music, you know. And then I remember wondering at that time, what is my kids' generation going to do that could possibly upset me the way, you know, wearing torn jeans and long hair upset my parents' generation? And along came piercings and tattoos. And I was like, oh, there it is, you know. not that big a deal in the grand scope of life, but I wonder what it's going to be for your kids, you know, in 10 or 15 years from now. I wonder what the new shocking thing is going to be. You know, it's almost like it's like every generation has to invent something shocking so that they can be different, so that they can escape this boredom, so that they can not have to feel like they don't count. And this is the key point, I think, is that kids' boredom often stems from the knowledge that they are not important. Not important. They may be important to us emotionally, but if we don't rely on them in any way, they're really not important to us functionally. And this is something that really hurts the soul of a child, to not be important functionally. You know, I don't want this to sound as masochistic as it might, but I was kind of glad when we lived in the Amazon region that one of us was sick almost all the time with different kinds of dysenteries and things like that. And it wasn't fun, but there was something really, really cool about that, that one of us was sick almost all the time. And what would be the cool thing about that? you have to take care of each other. You know, you have to, you know, you have to make your kids go get you aspirin for your fever or to do this or to do that. And it's not in a heavy way. It wasn't like everybody was dying all the time. But there were always needs. There were always things that, you know, to say, oh, honey, I really need you to go do this or I really need you to go do that. And there was so there would be an interdependence within the family. And so often we rob our children of interdependence because we want to do everything for them, or if they're unhappy, we want to deal with that unhappiness. And sometimes they just need to sit in their unhappiness and need to do things they don't want to do anyway. It also comes from the fact that they're not engaged in meaningful work and relationships and that they don't count in the community except as a taker. And you know what? Kids get this. They really get it. Sometimes we as parents don't even realize that they're not functionally important anywhere, but they get it. And it's amazing to see the difference in a child when they suddenly start perhaps getting involved in working at a food pantry, or they start doing some tutoring, or their parents take them with them to do some kind of carrying meals to the elderly, or whatever it is. Kids, when they get it, when they start feeling like what they're doing is important, it really makes a huge difference in the way they think about themselves. This is the can of worms I was referring to, and I was out of order. But I want to talk about this just a little bit. And I want to say that I am not against academics, and I'm not against sports. I think that getting a good education is a really significant thing. And sports, you know, it's a healthy outlet, you know, all that stuff. Okay, disclaimer aside, I want to look a little bit, though, at how academics and sports function in our culture today. What do academics and sports have in common? What do they have in common? A couple of ideas?
Performance-based.
Performance-based, yes, thank you. And Beck, that was what you were going to say. Anything else?
They take hard work.
Okay, they take hard work. They're performance-based. Any other quick ideas? What do they have in common?
Discipline.
They take discipline, yeah.
Time-consuming.
They're time-consuming. All right, all of those are true. They're competitive. You know, they are about who is better than whom. They are graded and ranked. You know, you get the slow learners class and the medium learners class and the excelled learners class. You know, and you have the different divisions, and you have select soccer and basic soccer and all that kind of stuff. And they focus on achievement. They're primarily about me, about what I do and where I stand in relation to other people. And they have their good side, but there's a real dark side to our kids being heavily involved in taking their identity from either their academic performance or their sports. It's fascinating to me when I run across old friends or friends with children, and I say, hey, how are the kids doing? I would say over 90% of the time when I ask the question, how are your kids, they will refer either to their academic performance and standing or to what sports teams they're on and how their sport team is doing that season. Does this ring a bell? On the one hand, it's just kind of social stuff. It's kind of like saying, how are you? I'm fine. On the other hand, if that's what we think, that our kids are doing well or not doing well because of those criteria, there's just an immense poverty in that. Why would I say that there's an immense poverty in that? Yeah?
What they do is not who they are.
That's a really important part. Yeah, what they do is not who they are. And the focus on what they do is not the most important thing. What do we often see in successful teens, the ones that are good at sports and academics? Those of you who work with teenagers or have recently been a teenager or have teenager friends, what do you often see in kids who are really, really good at academics and really, really good at sports? Yes?
They don't have good friends.
Wow. Why is that?
Because they spend 4 or 5 hours a day doing sports or
whatever. Yeah, they spend 4 or 5 hours a day, literally, doing the sports or the academic pursuits. Yeah, an awful lot of times they don't have good friends. Anything else? Yes, way back there, there's a mic right behind you.
I guess they're feeling a lot of pressure these days, too, from what I hear.
Pressure and stress. You know, it really depends on the kid. And I have known some kids who had a high academic performance and were involved in sports and yet were grounded, relational, understood the concept of agency and had a positive emotional life, but I've also seen an awful lot who are deeply stressed out. I think of one girl who's now just turned 21 and has made like straight A's her whole life, was on the select cheerleading team at the same time that she was the soccer goalie, at the same time that she was, you know, everything. And I've never, you know, excelling in all these national academic societies and things like that. And this girl is plagued by a deep and abiding, constant stress that manifests itself in big emotional outbursts that has required some psychiatric intervention. And I think, what is happening here? There is so much stress involved because they get into a system where they have to be the best, or they have to do really, really well, or they at least have to do better than most of the other kids. And for those kids that are in that academic sports mindset and don't make it to the top, what happens with them? Any ideas? How do you feel if the academics and the sports is the measure of your society and you're just not there? A failure as a person, totally out of step with other people. I had a lot of trouble with that when I was a kid because I was extraordinarily uncoordinated. And for whatever reason, I almost flunked first, second, and third grade and only learned to read when I was in fourth grade. So I was very much one of the school idiots in a lot of ways, you know, socially, academically. There were three kids in the school that got picked on, and I was one of them because I just had no idea how to respond to that kind of thing, you know, and wasn't good at anything. You know, I don't think that that means that my life couldn't count for anything. I don't think it means that there wasn't really any intelligence there, but the mainstream sport, the mainstream academic thing doesn't pick up on all the kids. And there are some really smart kids, some very capable kids, and some kids with amazing heart who are walking around feeling like total failures because they don't fit quite into that mainstream. So that's one of the issues, is that the ones that have great success oftentimes live with a life of significant anxiety. You know, am I going to be able to maintain this? I've known of children who just fall apart when they get a B in a class because they've never had one before, you know, and this kind of thing. Or they think, I'm the best thing. I'm so important. I'm so much better than everybody else because I fit into this narrow corridor of high academic, high sports achievement. Well, what else do academics and sports have in common? They can mask relational weakness, and that's what Laura was referring to. So often, if a kid is doing well academically or doing well in sports, the parents will say, oh, well, I guess it's okay that he doesn't have any friends because he's doing so well. You know, or I've heard people say, well, you know, I said, how's your kid doing? And sometimes they'll just go into a long thing about, you know, he's so isolated, doesn't listen, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of the list of problems and relational issues that they're really concerned about, say, well, but he gets really good grades, and I'm really happy with that. Wow. You know, so that kind of performance can mask relational weakness and make us not focus on that. Another one is that sports and academics are easier for parents than promoting biblical agency. Why do I say that they're easier? Because it's really, sports and academics are a lot of hard work. But why is it easier?
Because they're mainly someone else's responsibility.
They're mainly someone else's responsibility. Yeah, it's up to the school. It's up to the tutor. It's up to the coach. It's up to, all we need to do really, it's a lot of work, but all we really need to do is drive them there. Yeah?
It's also measurable, because you get a number or a letter grade, or you get a score.
It's measurable, and it makes us feel better or feel worse, depending on how that measurement goes. Holly, is there a mic over here? For Holly. There we go.
Thanks. I think, too, it's a lot more acceptable to be great at athletics or just whatever the world says is great. So,
yeah, it's acceptable. So, but promoting biblical agency is more difficult then. Why? Linda?
The biblical agency takes a lot of effort and a lot of willingness to look at your own faults to be able to address that in somebody else.
Yes. Say that again louder.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
It's okay.
I have a really big mouth, so I'm afraid I'm going to break it. You have to be willing to look in the mirror to address your own problems before you can start intervening and creating an agent in someone else.
Okay. It requires that we be agents first, and that we be agents in ways that are visible to our children, that we not be consumers, that we not be dissatisfied, that we be moving out there to meeting the needs of others. And then, if that weren't hard enough, it requires that we drag them along with us, you know, and help them also to learn how to do those things. So it's way more time-consuming. But let's look at this for just a second. What is the focus of biblical agency? It is belonging to a group effort to care for the weak, the needy, the poor, the sick, or the foreigners in our midst. Kind of a broad definition. But one of the two key words in here is that the focus of biblical agency is belonging to a group effort. A group effort. So that agency, the way God looks at it, is never just the Lone Ranger that goes out and does all this cool social work all by themselves. It's belonging to a community that has that same kind of vision and can very naturally pull our children into service to other people, whether they be needy, poor, sick, or foreigners, and in whatever way that manifests itself. That's the focus of biblical agency. And what does it do? One of the things it does for our kids is empowerment. Now, empowerment is a word that, I don't know, sometimes is used in cool ways and sometimes isn't. But what we mean here is that when our kids are empowered, when they feel like they what they can do makes a difference, and when they feel like they can move out and do things, it's things that, like, they can learn to build. They can care for others. They can learn to negotiate. They can learn how to get information. They can console. They can change their mind. Now, what does changing your mind have to do with empowerment? What does changing your mind have to do with empowerment? Yes?
Thinking for yourself.
Yeah, let's just grab the mic.
That's it.
Oh, thinking for yourself? Yeah, being able to say, I used to think this, and now I think something else. Being able to say, I used to think it was like this, and I've looked at new things, and I'm able to change my mind. That requires a certain amount of self-confidence. Lots of times we stay stuck in the same old attitudes just because we don't have the confidence to say, hey, wait a minute, I think I need to be going this way instead. Changing your mind is really about empowerment. Learning how to deliver to other people, to create. So there's all kinds of ways that we can teach our kids, and all kinds of temperaments and all kinds of personalities can fit into to some or any of those different things. What does agency produce? This kid is, you know, it's like, he's not saying, you know, it's not a, it's all about me and I can conquer the world, but it produces a level of excitement about and fulfillment about what life is because we're engaged. It opens the doors and their horizons. My husband, before we went to live in Brazil, worked with youth gangs, street gangs here in Columbus. And since he's come back, he works with inmates in state and federal penitentiaries. So he's worked with a lot of people who have had a lot of trouble in their life and have gotten caught up in a lot of activity that was really unhealthy. And I was talking to him the other day, and what he said I thought was really significant. He said, the more that kids are tied to a bigger world, the less dependent they are on the opinions and approval of kids in their small world. Does that make sense? You know, we worry so much about peer pressure, about, you know, what all the other teenagers are doing and all that. But the more they have an open horizon, the more they see God at work in many ways, the more they're connected to a group of people here and a group of people here, the more they feel like they're really engaging with the world around them. That's okay. The less dependent they are on a small group of kids' approval and having to do everything that that group of kids says that they have to do. So family integrated ministry, I think, is one of the most significant ways of being able to deal with this, to find ways where you and your family can work together and your children can come along with you as you're meeting the needs of other people. This is teaching them to give of themselves and being involved in things together. Not just separate projects, like I'm going to drop you off for your hour at the food pantry while I go off to do something else, you know, or I'm going to do this ministry while you're in school and then tell you about it, or I'm going to drop you off at the babysitter while I go and do this ministry. But integrating our kids, integrating our family life so that ministry and taking care of people is a natural and common kind of thing. So agency has an impact. Kids will feel fulfilled when they have learned to live and develop in an interdependent kind of community and have a long-term positive impact on other people. Well, I'm going to make one last point, and then we'll be done, and talk about sex education. And you think, what on earth does sex education have to do with agency? Any ideas? Oh, there's one right away. Just a second. Wait for... We've got a couple. What does sex education have to do with this? Yeah?
I think because people want to feel like they matter, sometimes they can turn to sex in order to get that feeling.
Okay, if a child doesn't think they matter, or a teen doesn't think they matter, that's a huge, it has a huge impact. What else?
That their sexual interactions and activities have an impact on other people's feelings.
Exactly. Agency teaches kids that they have an impact on other people. Fantastic. What else? If our kids really feel biblical, understand biblical agency, if they know I matter, the things that I do have an impact on other people, then they're going to look at dating in a whole new way. It's not about using somebody. It's not about having the cutest girl in town so that I look good. It's not about I need because I feel so empty. Our kids are going to be far more stable in this area and far more respectful in their dating relationships as a result of it. When teens have respect for others and understanding that their actions have input, I mean, you guys are like exactly these points, and when they are, then they are far better prepared to deal with the temptations and plan for a healthy dating life than if they're bored and feel like something is missing in life. So that kind of, it amazes me how this idea of agency is as an integral part of who we are in every aspect of our life and at every phase of our life. I'm now in the empty nester phase of life, and I was really worried about that for many years. I had this idea that when I was an empty nester, I wouldn't have anything to do, and now I can't find time to do what I want to do. But, you know, I needed to know, to reinvent myself at 50, I needed to find a new way to have an impact, a new way to know that my life matters. You know, and each one of us at different phases of life are going to have to go through that. Sometimes we reinvent ourselves as mothers. Sometimes we reinvent ourselves as empty nesters or as professionals. But we all need to know that whatever it is that we're doing, we matter. Any kind of questions or ideas that come up from what we've been talking about? Yeah, back there.
I guess I just want to put a plug in for not giving up doing what you know is right. Because I have a preteen who is just going through hormones and just the angry grimaces and the disrespect and just the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I've learned in my short time parenting is that don't expect immediate rewards.
Exactly.
But plan for the long-term rewards.
Thank you.
My daughter is volunteering in OASIS, and she took a break from her unrelenting negativity and discontent and anger to tell me this brief story about how this little girl ran up to her at the playground while she was out there and just was talking. She said, "Mom, that girl never says a word in OASIS, but she saw me and came over to talk to me and tell me about her day." And I could just see that feeling of I mattered in OASIS. I made a difference. And she even deigned to tell me about it.
Wow. That is agency. I have a friend whose daughter was very rebellious during her middle teenage years, and she ran off and she got pregnant with an African-American, which doesn't matter except that it wasn't for this long-term love relationship. It was just an angry rebellion thing. What could I do that would most piss off my parents? You know, and she spent a lot of years just kind of out there in this whole rebellious thing. And when she came back to her faith and came back to her family and came back to living in a way where she mattered and was making a positive contribution to other people, what she said was, "The thing that brought me back and the thing that kept me grounded was that no matter how bad I was, no matter how rebellious I was, no matter how hard I tried to do whatever it would possible could make my parents angry, it didn't change the way they lived. They kept doing their own ministries. They kept living their lives with their own sense of agency. They kept making a contribution and making a difference in other people's lives, and it was just too attractive to turn down." And when she felt totally empty, she came back to saying, "I want a life like that." You know, so no matter how our kids act at different ages of their lives, our having a sense of agency makes a huge impact for them. Can we get back? There we go.
I just wanted to say that the whole focus on sports and the competitiveness, I think that does just flow into our adult lives. Like what you started with, like competitive parenting and judging of other people. I mean, I think it does because we don't have that relationship. We don't care. We just want to compare and compete and I'm doing a better job than so-and-so, because that fills us.
Yeah. I'm a very competitive, driven kind of person, you know, so it's real easy for me to fall into comparing how things are going. But there's some things about being driven that are good, too. We can teach our kids, if they're competitive and driven, we can teach them to channel that in really positive ways. Back here.
I was just thinking, I think, too, we have to realize it's not all on us as mm-hmm. parents. One, it's a spiritual battle.
Yep.
So, you know, it's going to be really hard for us to give this biblical perspective to our kids who were competing against the world, and so is the evil one. On their side, trying mm-hmm. to get them. On the other hand, too, though, as parents, I think really going to God on this and asking Him, you know, to really impact our children's lives, because we're going to be out of the picture, you know, and they may come back, which would be great, you know, but regardless, we want them to know God, and we need God, you know, them to open their hearts to Him first.
Otherwise,
we can do everything in the world, and, you know, it's a gamble.
That puts the perspective around this whole conversation today. You know, it is a spiritual battle, and it is something that we are not 100% responsible for. And it's a hard thing, and there are plenty of distractions. I remember working in an ICU in Chicago, and it was a very fast-paced, decision-driven, you know, difficult environment in a lot of ways. And then after I'd been home with kids for a couple of years, I realized that being a parent was harder. You know, it's harder because it's not protocol, and it's not black and white, and there's so many different kinds of decisions that we have to make. It's not an easy thing, and that's why we need each other, and we need community, and we need to be together to talk about these things, because everybody needs some help on that journey. Yeah.
Thank you. This was an awesome, awesome thing to come to, and I just feel very overwhelmed when I do, because... you know, if you're sold out to Christ, as most of us are, that's what we want our kids to be. And, you know, we're all works in progress, as are our kids. And so I was just trying to get, like, maybe some practical tips or ideas on how we can maybe kind of determine if our kids are on the right track as far as, just... that we're having a positive influence and not transmitting all our, and also I was just kind of, lots going around in my head, but like I've got, there are people in our home church who have older children and, you know, I see the teenage rebellion thing and just trying to understand like how much of that is just, I mean, it's going to happen and it's
some
natural
of it's just
versus, wow, this child is really... misunderstood or just doesn't get it?
This is a big question. Let me just chunk it down a little bit. How do I know if my kid's on the right track? I want to say it's a little bit like taking a blood pressure. When you go into your doctor's office and they take your blood pressure, it's usually a lot higher than it is at home, right? They call that the white jacket syndrome or something like that. You get nervous. And no doctor will ever prescribe medication for blood pressure based on one reading. You know, you have to really take your blood pressure over every day at different times of day over the course of about a month, and then you really know what your issues are. And it's the same way with kids. We can never take their temperature or their blood pressure on one day and say, oh, yeah, this kid's doing great or this kid's doing bad. We really need to see what is the direction of the kid's life, you know. What kind of things do they tend to want to do? What kind of attitudes do they have? What are they drawn by? And that kind of thing. So it's not a, you know, my kid blew up today and said some really disrespectful things and slammed the door. You know, I must be a terrible parent and my child must be totally off track. That could be an absolutely normal day for a 14-year-old. So it's really more about looking at what kind of relationships are they able to develop and sustain, and whether or not they're able to experience and express empathy in their lives. I would say those would be some of the most important things. Yeah, and also everybody else's teenagers always look worse to us than they do to their parents. You know, because we think, I wouldn't put up with that. But then when our kids are teenagers, we think, oh, well, I guess I have to deal with this. Because they're all like that. I mean, all teenagers have an inborn need to be rebellious to some extent, because none of us want to be exactly like our parents. We all want to be different and distinct. And that pulling away is real normal.